We will talk with a guest expert this hour about what the U.S. could or should do to stop extremists from toppling Iraq. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, June 17th. Forces of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, have taken over the cities of Mosul and Tikrit and are headed towards Baghdad. New fighting in the news this morning has broken out in the Iraqi city of Bakuba after Sunni extremists retreated after fighting there last night. President Obama is weighing his options, though he has ruled out ground troops and says that military action without political changes in Iraq would not do any good. The president is sending 275 U.S. forces to Iraq for embassy security. So we will talk about what's happening in Iraq and wonder what you think the U.S. should do. What questions do you have about the crisis in Iraq? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her areas of expertise include defense strategy and policy, military operations, national security, and civil-military relations. She also served in the Obama administration as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Plans, where she oversaw the development of guidance for military campaign and contingency plans. And she wrote a piece for the Council on Foreign Relations about what's happening in Iraq. It was entitled, On Iraq, No Quick or Easy Solution. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Well, I'll say this is a real mess. Tell us in simple terms what's going on in Iraq.
Well, what's going on in Iraq depends on how far back you want to go. In the immediate is this group called ISIS or ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or Iraq and the Levant, which is a very, very violent, virulent, extremist group of Sunni fighters, militants, whose goal it is basically to take over a large swath of land between Syria and Iraq. They don't respect the borders. They aren't their borders. And have an Islamic State. In order to do that, they are basically taking over town by town in Iraq. They've already taken lots of area in Syria as well. They are part of the resistance groups in Syria, which is one of the reasons why it's been so hard to intervene and help in Syria, because the groups in Syria that are rising up against the Syrian government are not unified. Some are worse than others, and this is about the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
In fact, they're so bad, Al-Qaeda has disavowed them.
Really? Oh, my goodness.
That's
so right. So and why? So they're advancing towards Baghdad? Why are they doing that?
Because they want to take over Iraq, basically. Now, you know, this goes back a little bit further, if I can. When we invaded Iraq in 2003, There was no Al-Qaeda there necessarily. There were bad people there, but you know, there was no Al-Qaeda there. This group originally formed as what was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they were extreme. They were loosely affiliated with Al-Qaeda. They kind of bickered with Al-Qaeda's central leadership, you know, back at the home office, if you will. And but they became so violent that the Sunnis in Iraq rose up against them. That was what was called the awakening. And that is when General Petraeus's surge, when we were there in 2006, 2007, decided to help or was able to help. So we fought alongside Sunni tribal leaders in various places in Iraq against these guys and basically defeated them. At the time, they have since gained momentum and morphed and gone to Syria, gotten better armed, better equipped, better funded, and they have recruited all across this region and come back now as new and improved ISIS. And they are able to now, ironically, recruit from that same sort of Sunni base that fought against them 7 years ago because of the horribly inept rule of Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq.
And we read that the Iraqi forces are laying down their arms and running away. Why weren't these Iraqi forces, who are trained by the U.S. or helped train by the U.S., why aren't they fighting back?
Right. So I think there are two answers to that question about what's happening with the Iraq, at least two answers. So you are correct that when we finally left in December of 2011 under the agreement with Prime Minister Maliki, I believe, and a lot of people believed at the time, that we had put Iraq, you know, for however horrendous the war was and ill-conceived to begin with, by 2011, we had put Iraq on a decent footing, that the leadership of Iraq was capable of then taking it to the next level and continuing the positive trajectory. Part of that positive trajectory, and about the most important one, was the rebuilding and the professionalization and the training of the Iraqi army. So what then happened was Prime Minister Maliki did everything that we suggested, recommended, and advised him not to do, which is he then immediately went after, instead of creating a unified Sunni Shia government, he proceeded to start to throw high-level Sunni officials out of the government and arrest them. Wow. He cracked down on Sunni protesters that were protesting for democracy and inclusive government. And he looked at the military that had been built, and he picked out people that he didn't think were – he picked out his Sunni adversaries and placed inept leadership across the organization. And that, more than probably anything else, has led to a sort of reversal of the positive trajectory of that professionalized army. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you look where ISIS has started where they started their march up in Mosul and northern Iraq, those are Sunni strongholds. And so they've been able to, they have some sympathizers there because Prime Minister Maliki has been so non-inclusive and has cracked down on Sunnis. I mean, the Sunnis don't necessarily love ISIS, but they hate Maliki more. And so they've been able to get sort of support from the population. And the poor army guys that are up in those regions were just completely overwhelmed.
Yeah. So President Obama on Friday says he's keeping his options open. Options are on the table except for sending combat troops to Iraq. Why is he ruling that out?
Well, I think one of the things that we've learned over time is that in these sectarian conflicts or in any environment, even where you are trying to intervene to even to save lives, if the host nation, in this case Iraq, if the government of that country that is under assault, if they're not willing to make the kinds of changes that are going to get at the root problems, then you're just adding fuel to the fire. If we were to intervene whole scale on the side of Prime Minister Maliki, we would be taking a side in this horrendous civil war and basically promoting all the things that I just described that he's been doing over the last 3-4 years. So that makes it really, really hard because there are a lot of people suffering in Iraq and they need help. So in the short term, as you heard John Kerry say, there may be things you can do to sort of, you know, stop the killing, even without boots on the ground. But even that is a military, from a military perspective, is very hard to do. But that doesn't get at the root problems, and in some cases can make things worse if you don't do it right. So they're really trying to take a medium to long-term view with also a short-term sensibility about how can we stop the atrocities in the short term without making things worse in the long term.
We are talking about the crisis, the civil war in Iraq, and what options are before the United States, and wondering what you think the U.S. should do about the Sunni extremists who are threatening to topple the government of Iraq. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We are talking with Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She wrote a piece on the situation in Iraq, saying there is no quick or easy solution, but we will talk with her as we go along about what she thinks can be done to right this sinking ship. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's now 21 minutes past 7 o'clock, we are talking with a guest expert about what the U.S. could or should do about the crisis in Iraq. And we're welcoming your questions and your views, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to John in Madison first. Hello, John.
Hi. I can't imagine for a second that the U.S. will give up its client-state relationship with Iraq. We've denationalized the oil, and that was the essential reason we went in there. We also caused this civil war because Hussein was not sectarian. But let's just say we don't use cruise missiles, and I guess they're also proposing JSOC troops and probably military, an air offensive to stop this. But say this didn't happen, what would happen, as Joe Biden, when he was senator, proposed, that the country fragment into a Kurdish area? They already have a semi-autonomous Kurdistan in the north, and also a Sunni and Shiite subdivision of the country, sort of like what happened to Yugoslavia inevitably after World War II. Are they afraid the virus of self-determination is going to spread across the Middle East, or the transnational oil interests are going to be affected?
Comment on a lot there, Janine?
Sure. First of all, let's start with a couple facts. I would actually agree with the caller. I didn't catch his name, but I would agree with the caller that we, in many ways, caused the current civil war. Because of just the unleashing of the sectarian sentiment that has been there for years and years. There have been plenty of periods throughout Iraq's history where people have lived side by side peacefully, but not in the recent era. I would actually disagree with the caller about his characterization of Saddam Hussein not being sectarian. He was the reason Iraq was so stable during Saddam Hussein's reign was because he was a brutal dictator that oppressed the majority Shiite population and who put his crony Ba'athist Sunnis in charge everywhere. And so, you know, this is, after years and years of this, this is part of the reason why the Shia population in Iraq is so ready for revenge. And in fact, if you look at the biography of Prime Minister Maliki, during most of the reign of Saddam Hussein, he was in exile, self-exile, in Iran. He was an agitator against the Saddam rule. He's been waiting for this moment, and we helped give it to him in a lot of ways. We had, I think, felt as though that he was going to not, you know, that he was ready to have some peaceful reconciliation among the two groups, but he's proven to do the exact opposite. And so this is a problem. You have groups in Iraq who have been fighting for and have been oppressing each other over time, have been trading off, and they're going to fight it out. So the question that the caller asks about sort of what next, nobody has a crystal ball, but some of these scenarios that you might be worried about, you could imagine a situation where this region, even across Syria and Iraq, does sort of break itself into regions that are defined by their ethnic makeup. One of the things that's happened since ISIS has driven into Iraq has been that the Kurds up in the northern region, there are Kurds, Shia, Sunni are the three main groups in Iraq. The Kurds have taken the opportunity to take over their area of what they have been wanting to make a separate state called Kurdistan for decades. You could imagine this kind of thing happening, but not without an incredibly long and bloody fight, which is what you're about to see, which is what you're starting to see happen, and which is what people in the region rightly want to avoid, if for no other reason, for the very good reason that a lot of people are going to suffer and be killed. A lot of innocent civilians are already on the march, and the human rights organizations are becoming overwhelmed with these refugee camps that are becoming morphing between Syria and Iraq.
Yeah. So if Iraq falls to ISIS, what does that mean for U.S. interests there, to the Middle East region? Some say, just let them fight it out. Who cares? Should we care?
Well, the reason people care, number one, the ISIS vision is al-Qaeda's vision on steroids. Okay, remember what al-Qaeda always wanted was an Islamic caliphate across this big swath. Part of the reason why people like to say that, ISIS, like I said at the beginning, is so bad that al-Qaeda, disavowed them. And that is true. They are more violent and a little more radical on the one hand. On the other hand, they have a disagreement in strategy with al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda Central has been, I don't know if they're decimated, but they have definitely been undermined through all, the last decade of fighting with us in their core headquarters region, which is Afghanistan and Pakistan. But their strategy was to, seek this Islamic caliphate, but to do it not overnight. And in fact, even inside al-Qaeda, there was a debate over what happened on 9/11, people thinking that they overstretched and sort of blew it. And so, fast forward to ISIS, they have a different strategy. Their strategy is more violent. They're less patient. They want it to happen quickly. And in their vision, then they'll have an Islamic State over this region that will be, all the brutal elements of the misinterpretation of Islam. And that's a problem for the region. But it's also a problem beyond the region, because number one, they obviously would like it the bigger the better, and they'll continue to push to spill it over into larger parts of the region. And so it's definitely a concern to the countries in the region, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and even Turkey, which, oh, by the way, is a NATO ally. And so then it becomes even a problem for us. We already know that a number of these fighters, ISIS's recruiting is global. Young men and some women have been flocking to this region in order to earn their stripes and fight on the side of ISIS for the Islamic Caliphate, or even just against people that they don't like. And many of those people have Western passports, Europe and American even. And so a lot of counterterrorism experts that track this very closely are very concerned about what happens to those guys when they come home. Do we wake up 5 years from now or 10 years from now and say, oh, my God, we should have seen this coming, because here they are. And so that is the really messy and dangerous part of what's happening there.
We will check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we will talk more about what can the U.S. do about the civil war in Iraq. Our guest wrote a piece for the Council on Foreign Relations, No Quick or Easy Solution in Iraq. We'll find out what solution there could be. And we will welcome more of your thoughts and questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. We are talking about the violence in Iraq and what can be done about it, whether the U.S. should get involved or not, and welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest expert. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. President Obama is weighing his options about what to do about the violence by Sunni extremists in Iraq. The president has ruled out U.S. ground troops and says military action without political changes in Iraq would not do any good. So what are the short-term and long-term options for the United States when it comes to the civil war in Iraq? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org if you have a question or a view for our guest. She is Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her areas of expertise include defense strategy and policy, military operations, national security, and civil-military relations. She also served on the Obama administration as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Plans, where she oversaw the development of guidance for military campaign and contingency plans. She wrote a piece for the Council on Foreign Relations on Iraq, No Quick or Easy Solution. We have so many callers, but we have not yet got to the vision that you have, Janine Davidson. Let's talk some first. Why no quick or easy solution?
Well, I don't know if I have the perfect vision. I think a lot of people can agree on the problem and really, really disagree on the solution. I think that a lot of the bad options are a lot more clear than the good options, and I know that sounds like a platitude, but let me unpack it for you a little bit. You know, President Obama is right to say that if the Maliki government is not going to make political changes, then it would be, as counterinsurgency doctrine 101 says, it would be folly for outside intervention to add fuel to the fire. So that's the danger here that we want to avoid. We want to avoid making things worse in the medium and long term because we're so concerned about the short term. And I think that the very, very uncomfortable truth about these kinds of conflicts is that they are not just like a kitchen fire that you're going to put out with one quick, easy thing. People all over the news are like, you know, who are we going to bomb? You know, what kind of airstrikes can we do? And, you know, airstrikes are a tool, but it's like a squirt gun on a 5-alarm fire, you know? So sure, we can push back. We can potentially push back in the very short term, assuming that ISIS is, you know, these guys are in pickup trucks with, you know, AK-47s and, which, you know, machine guns and rocket propelled grenades and, you know, hand served weapons. You know, they don't have tanks. They don't have big conventional. This is not a big conventional army, but they have been able to do a lot of damage. And so, you know, you have to look at, in the short term, people say if they are coming from the north of Iraq and they're marching on Baghdad, if they're in some wide open field, airstrikes can probably kill a lot of them. But there will be more, you know, and they will keep coming. And so how do you get to more of the root causes and without it becoming our fight? So I guess what I'm saying is what can be done versus what should be done are very different things.
Mm-hmm.
We could send in a huge force to fight these guys off, and it would be, you know, like a surge all over again. But again, if then we leave, and or even if we stay, and the root disagreements between the Shia and the Sunni are still there, and if Prime Minister Maliki is not doing what he's supposed to be doing to reconcile these two groups, ISIS will continue to grow. They will continue to be able to recruit from the disgruntled Sunni population, and it will just get worse and worse.
Let me play a clip from Secretary of Defense John Kerry, who acknowledged yesterday to Katie Couric in an interview that there could be some U.S. Iran cooperation regarding Iraq. Here's Secretary Kerry.
We're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran, if Iran is prepared to do something that is going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq and the ability of the government to reform.
So how could Iran be a strategic partner to U.S. interest? Do you think that's something that's going to happen?
So I think it could happen, actually. This is another one of those very interesting things about this region. People switch sides a lot. Like I explained in the first half of the show, you know, we fought alongside the Iraqi Sunnis, the Iraqi Sunni tribes, against these a previous version of the ISIS. And now many of those people in those Sunni populations are joining ISIS and helping fuel the fire. So that people, the sides switch as the situation switch. Now the issue with Iran is that across the region, you have Arabs, Sunni, Shia, and you have in Iran you have Persians who are Shia. And during the brutal rule of Saddam Hussein, you know, a lot of Iraqi Shia were in Iran. Prime Minister Maliki has very close relations with the Iranians. And this has always been something that has concerned us, because what we don't want is for Iran to just be Iraq to be a client state of Iran, on the one hand. On the other hand, we recognize that Iran has leverage over Maliki. And although we have had little luck getting Maliki to do the right political things to get at the root causes of this problem, a lot of people would question, why would today be different? Well, today may be different because it may very well be the case that for once, the Iranians are telling him the same thing. And so to the extent that we can get, or we can agree with the Iranians on a very, you know, specific course of action on the political moves that Maliki needs to take, then it actually is in our interest to have those discussions with the Iranians. And I don't know for a fact what exactly has been happening in these conversations, but we know they've been happening. They've been talking about it on the news. And I think that there is some opportunity there.
Let's go back to the phones. Ted in Monaco is with us. Hello, Ted.
The president is right that we never get much of a thank you note for all these countries that we help. But the people who campaigned against Obama, such as McCain and Romney, were absolutely right that announcing a timetable ahead of time of our retreat would lead to disaster. And now thousands of Iraqis are being beheaded and killed while the president still has his training wheels on after 5 years of continuing failure. And it just makes me sick because the accomplishments of our soldiers were for nothing, and it must feel terrible.
So is this so President Obama's fault for announcing a timetable for withdrawal?
Actually, let me correct a couple facts here. Iraq and Afghanistan are different. In Iraq, the Bush administration, before they left, came to an agreement with the Iraqis and set and announced a timetable for our withdrawal. So this is in 2008, 2009, and they they had a written agreement that said that we would be leaving at the very end in December of 2011. So that when the Obama the Obama administration came in, there was, you know, a clause in that agreement that says, you know, ... unless we decide agree mutually on something else. And so the Obama administration negotiated with the Maliki administration and were unable to come to an agreement that would protect our soldiers on the ground. They refused to give them the same kind of status of forces, legal immunity that troops have all over the world when they're operating in another country like that. And so both sides agreeing to disagree, and both sides also agreeing that Iraq had gotten to the point that was stable enough and that their security forces were competent enough to continue the trajectory to peace. And I think that is a true characterization of what was happening at the time. I think what the caller is referring to is what actually happened in Afghanistan, which is different, where in 2009, after a lot of deliberation with the Pentagon, President Obama agreed on a surge into Afghanistan, only a much sort of smaller version of what was done in Iraq. And when he announced that, he announced a date certain for withdrawal, which many of us would agree with the caller was not the most useful thing to do. And so why is it okay in Iraq to announce a date certain, but not okay in Afghanistan to announce a date certain? And the difference is the state of the conflict at the time. In Iraq, things were stable. We were ready for handoff. In Afghanistan, we were still in the middle of the fight. So you're translating to the Taliban what your intentions are. And so people are debating over whether that was wise or not. And I do think that there's a lesson to be learned there about what kinds of things you announce in the middle of the fight.
Our guest is Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we are talking about Iraq and the violence in Iraq by Sunni extremists who are toppling city after city on the march toward Baghdad. Talking about what should be done by the U.S. To stop this violence, to intervene in this civil war. What do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. What should the U.S. do about the Sunni extremists who threaten to topple the government of Iraq? We are talking with a guest expert about the options before the U.S., and we are welcoming your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's see. Let's go to Tom in Green Bay next. Hello, Tom.
Hi. This weekend I was talking to a guy that retired as the eastern half of the United States. He worked for Shell Oil. He's the head of that. And he wrote an article in one of the oil journals regarding if the instability stays like it is, the Chinese don't have oil reserves, and they might come into that area and replace what we were doing.
China's going to get involved in this, do you think, Janine Davidson?
Well, the oil market is a global market. I'm not an economist, but definitely there are linkages with conflict and the price of oil. We've seen that over and over again. The Chinese definitely have interests. They have interests everywhere. The Chinese have been in and out of Afghanistan. They've been in Africa. They will do what they need to do to secure their interests. But, you know, there are definitely oil reserves in Iraq, but I don't know that the Chinese oil market hinges on the reserves that are in Iraq. I mean, we were fighting a war there for 10 years, and the oil market in Iraq was disrupted. And so So, you know, that remains to be seen. Also, you know, I think it's important to know that in the reconstruction of Iraq, it isn't like a bunch of American companies just came in and scooped everything up and reaped benefits economically from, you know, the war in Iraq. In fact, the restrictions on Americans operating in Iraq and overseas in general, you know, made it such that there are a lot of other people. A lot of other countries all over Iraq setting up companies, and especially in the north and with the Kurds, helping them build their industries back. So Iraq has multinational corporations and other countries all over it, actually, that are not just American.
Thank you very much, Tom. Let's go next to Rick in Grafton. Hi, Rick.
How you doing? Enjoy your show. Real quick question. Why don't we use a tactic where the United States Special Forces cooperates with other countries' special forces and focus on eradicating or getting rid of the individual terrorist organizations versus a sweeping countrywide and need cooperation from those countries as well?
Well, Rick, actually, that I think is very similar to what the Obama administration announced with the president's speech at West Point graduation last month, almost. What he said was, you know, their approach to this counterterrorism is a long-term approach. There is no way that we can kill our way out of this global terrorist problem. You can't just keep killing the leadership and expect that the long-term problem will go away. In fact, you may undermine their ability to operate in the short term and even the medium term, which is, I think, what you've seen with the Al-Qaeda core in Afghanistan because of all the drone strikes and the long-term effort against them there. But Al-Qaeda and global terrorism has morphed. It's networked. It grows. It's more like an octopus. You can't just, you know, cut off its head and think that it's over. So with the approach, the current attempted approaches, and President Obama announced he would be requesting from Congress $5 billion to assist countries across this region to sustain their own stability under the operating theory that part of what allows terrorism to continue to grow is that these terrorist groups are able to continue to recruit. And they can recruit when their countries are in disarray, when their governments are failed or weak states, when they're not being provided services or opportunity. I mean, I think it's interesting to think. I talked about how we helped a lot of the Sunni tribes fight al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2007-2008. It seems like yesterday to some of us, but it was 7 years ago. Okay, the guys that are driving around in those pickup trucks with those weapons that have been recruited by ISIS are probably 18, 19, 20 years old. That means they were in puberty during the Iraq war. And so, you know, this thing will continue to grow until the countries in the region are able to provide security and governance and hope for the people across that region. And that's the uncomfortable truth about how hard it is to put this problem out overnight, and how if we do want to assist people in the region with this problem, and if we do want to make sure that it doesn't continue to spill over into places where we live, then it's got to be that kind of a long-term approach, indirect. And you're right, Special Forces has a role to play there.
Dennis in Menominee Falls. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, I'm curious. I haven't heard too much about what the international reaction or response has been to this. It's mostly, it seems to be in Obama's hands, and I'm wondering if that's just, you know, it's still our problem because we went in and went to war in Iraq.
Well, Dennis, I think that I agree. You haven't heard much from the international community. I think there's a lot of discussion going on behind the scenes. You did hear, I think, announcement from one of the leaders in the UK saying, you know, we need to help, but, you know, they haven't really said what and how. I think that this is one of those examples of where people, you're right, that people do look to the United States to lead on these issues. Not just because in this particular case people see it as our fault, and I don't blame them, and I do agree that we have a great deal of responsibility for what's been happening in Iraq. But however this thing started, and with other problems around the world, it isn't just the United States that will suffer and bear the consequences of global terrorism. So I think that it is in the interest of the Europeans, especially where a lot of these fighters come from and will go back to take an interest in the solution. And that means not just blindly following where the Americans lead, but being part of the conversation and part of the strategy on what to do about it. And I think that this is really at the core of President Obama's sort of grand strategy vision that he's always talking about. You know, he's happy for America to lead. He understands that we should lead in the global system, a system that we helped create and build after World War II, and that very much is in our interest to sustain. But that, you know, he wants others to step up and bear part of the cost as well. And that multilateral operations are much more legitimate and useful and successful than just having America go around and do it all itself.
This has been so informative, Janine Davidson. Thanks so much for being with us. We have just a minute to go. Can you, I guess, let us know what you think. Can the U.S., can the international community stop Iraq from falling, being toppled by these Sunni extremists?
The short answer is yes, I think we can, but I don't think it's going to happen overnight. In the very short term, we need to protect our civilians that are there in the embassy working day and night to help Iraq right the sinking ship.
Thank you so much for being with us.
This is my pleasure, Joy. Thank you.
Janine Davidson, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her areas of expertise include defense strategy and policy. She wrote a piece for the Council on Foreign Relations on Iraq, No Quick or Easy Solution. And we will post that on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Thank you to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thanks to Robin Cherry for on-air production and direction. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. It's On Your Money coming up next. We will talk with financial planner Kevin McKinley about student loans, about disability insurance, and about protecting ourselves from the sun. So that's coming up in our next hour. Stay with us. Much more to come here on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.